All right. Good morning and happy Monday. It is the 15th of July. Before you know it, we'll be through this month of July, August downhill to December. Winter will be over. Yippee.
And then we start again.
I don't want to wish anything away. I mean, I like, I enjoy every day. I like being alive, but winter I've had enough of. I'm up to here with it now, so. The sooner the better. I mean, I really do hope. And Cape Town, by the way, it's been raining here nonstop.
Yeah, I think there was some heavy flooding in areas too. So that's not always good. Mm. But it is rainy season, right, for Cape Town. So you get everything over and done with at once, the rain and the cold.
We came into land on Saturday and, the runway was really wet and it's never fun. You kind of worry that you're going to skid all over the place, but these pilots are so damn good at what they do and the planes are so good and it's just incredible. Like you don't even worry about it, frankly. And then driving from the airport out towards Stellenbosch, they're like all these new lakes that are like on either side of the road. It's just water everywhere. So Cape Town is now the Lake District. It's quite something. Wow. And going to sleep on Saturday night and last night, the rain kind of comes and you hear it like, coming down on the roof and then it's quiet and then it comes down again. It's like completely irregular. You get these bursts of rain. It's really, there's something quite magical about Cape Town in the winter, but it's not my favorite thing. And you say you kill two birds with one stone with the cold and the rain, but I prefer our summer rain in Gauteng, frankly.
Yeah, it's good. It's refreshing.
Carl says, I don't want winter to end. I was supposed to build a swimming pool this winter, but I've not got house plans yet. Slow the fuck down. Yeah, I've got to do something. I've got to do two things. And obviously the best stuff you can do at this time of year in Gauteng is the stuff that you don't want to do when it's raining. Like I have to paint the roof and I have to have some trees cut down because in winter it's the best time to do it, right? You can actually see what's going on. It's not all like green and overgrown. So those are big projects I have to get underway. But again, it's like these things are so expensive and irritating. Do you do it? Do you not do it? I know that I can't wait for summer. I've got to do it now. So I've just got to bite the bullet.
Sure. Now, one of the things, the projects that my brother and I have at the moment is moving my parents from the house they've been in for 20 years into something more manageable.
Right.
And it's the thing that you think about as a child, one day we're going to have to pack up this house.
Yeah.
And then it happens. And the amount of stuff you accumulate over 20 years, we've got our work cut out for us. We did like a bit of a surface scan the other day. And I think the plan was to start doing something, but it was just too overwhelming. Mm-hmm. There's an attic, there's a cottage, there's an office. It's going to be a lot.
Tell me, because I know we're not in the midst of summer now, but in the Northern Hemisphere they are. And there's apparently this thing that's going on. There's this trend on TikTok, which I know nothing about because I'm not on TikTok and I'm so grateful for it. But apparently they're using beer to get a tan. What's this all
about? Yeah, it's so stupid. It's another. The input I've had this morning is all about trains and stupid things that are happening. Because we have to be aware of them, right?
Yeah, right.
So there are some social media users are saying that cheap beer is the secret to a bronze summer tan. So we've heard of people using oil in our days. We did. We used to put on cooking oil and lie in the sun, which was really dangerous. We also spent a lot of time on sunbeds, which was really, really bad. But apparently now people are saying pour cheap beer on your skin in the sun to get a tan because the hops in the beer can make you tan faster. And so, of course, a clinical professor of dermatology at Stanford, Dr. Zakia Rahman, has said, unfortunately, this is wrong for many reasons. So, yes, firstly, no tan is a safe tan, number one.
Wow.
And the beer is absolutely doing nothing to help you tan or to protect you from the sun. It'll just help you get sunburned, basically. And no, I liked the year. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's what they're after. They just want to get a nice tan. I mean, there's so many ways to do this now that don't have to involve you actually lying in the sun or putting some dangerous shit on your skin. I mean, you know, I know that there are girls that, you know, are using those instant tanning, tan things.
Yeah, spray tans.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. There are lots of other ways. Apparently, you would, by pouring beer over your body, the alcohol's drying out your skin, so that's not good. And it will likely wash off any sunscreen that you have applied. You'll smell like cheap beer is one of the things that's not great about that. And also, it attracts bugs and insects and bees. So I want to see how that works.
Yeah, it's lovely. You basically get stung by a whole bunch of insects. All right, well, another stupid trend that, thank God for you, Leanna, we'd never know these things. It's very important.
I do like the accompanying cartoon, though. It's of a butt on the beach pouring beer onto his biceps and his chest. Yeah. And there's a black family sitting underneath the umbrella drinking beer and looking at their beers and to say, what the hell is this guy doing? They're just enjoying their beer.
I mean, Louis makes a very good comment. What a waste of beer. You know, for a South African to waste beer on a stupid tan is kind of crazy. Why does it seem like a beer tan would be the same as a car guard tan, says Carl? Yeah, I mean, we all know what a car guard tan looks like. And somebody else in the comments in the comment section made this comment. Lovely Lady Lee says, I can believe that. Have you seen the change in skin color on drunkards? You know, you get those drunks who like go this purple color. Not a great look.
Yeah, but that's from the inside, hey? That's like you're pickling on the inside, man.
All right, one last thing before we get to Professor Szabo, who I'm very keen to talk to. We haven't spoken to him in ages. But this, I always like to hear about the latest features on your phone that you don't know you can use. And evidently, no matter how well you think you know your phone, no matter how much you're on it or how much you use it, there are always things that you don't know you can do with your phone. So here is Leanne Moll with some useful tips that you probably didn't know about.
I saw this one quite a while back, and I haven't put it into use yet, but it's popping up again. And that's how you can send secret chats using iPhone notes on your phone. So I use notes a lot just to jot stuff down. But you can actually use it to send secret chats. You don't need these like shady apps or anything like that. Apparently, you basically go to compile a new note. It has to be a new note.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm just scrolling through the millions of ads that are popping up, which is very annoying. So you create a new compose button, new note, and then type anything in the note just to keep it. Otherwise, it'll automatically be deleted when you exit from the note. You can also go into an existing note. It's best to just start fresh.
Right.
Then you adjust the note's share options. So on the little more button, you would hit share note. And now you tap share options and make sure that you have the can make changes option selected under permission. Okay. You should also toggle off anyone can add people in case you want to be the only person who can add collaborators.
Right.
And then you now add the person that you want to share whatever it is with.
And then anything you type in that note, that other person will see updated on their phone.
Yes. It becomes a live documentary. So you can have your conversation. Yeah.
People don't check the notes app. So you'd probably get away with having these secret conversations. Maybe you're cheating on someone or something a lot more dodgy than that. That's clever.
Absolutely. So yeah, that's one way. I mean, obviously you can just delete it very easily. So that's how to send secret messages using notes.
Okay.
And then this one, which when I read it, I thought, I wonder how many people have done this to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's ever happened with you, but how to use your iPhone as a spy trick. So this lets you basically eavesdrop on people in the room while you've left the room. So it would work very well in like an office situation where you say, I'm off to the loo, leave your phone on the desk. And basically you need to have something called live listen, which turns your iPhone or your iPad into a microphone that sends sound to your AirPods or your Beats. It doesn't work with any other wireless headphones. It has to be AirPods or Beats.
Okay.
The feature is actually designed to help you hear a conversation in a noisy area. But you can actually just walk away with your AirPods and just listen to what people are saying about you after you've left the room.
I'm just thinking about the possible applications for this, because people are always trying to spy on each other and kind of hear things that they're not meant to hear. And you wouldn't think twice if someone left their phone on the table. In fact, you'd think the fact that they left their phone means that they trust you, because your phone is staying stable. So you go off to the bathroom, and then while you're in the bathroom, you can listen to what they're talking about with your phone sitting right there. That's wild.
I'm sure that somebody must have done it to us already. Surely. I work with developers. They know these things.
They do know these things. So basically, Leanne, I mean, you could have it the other way around, where they can hear you in the loo on your phone. I wonder if they can like reverse it so that basically they hear you flushing in.
And going, la la la.
La la la. Gosh. And, you know, yeah, like that was a very strong pee that she just had.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I think you're only safe saying things when you're far away from the office and your devices aren't near you.
Yeah, look, just, you know what? Don't do anything in secret anymore. Just like expect that someone somewhere is listening to everything that you say. There's no point. Just be yourself. Someone somewhere is going to listen, and it's none of their business, but they're going to hear things anyway. So don't have any secrets. Just be the same person, whether they're
let it all out. Around or not.
Just be you. Like, there's no point anymore. Someone somewhere is going to hear something that they're not meant to. And frankly, if it's you, then stand by it. Nothing to be embarrassed about if it's you and you're not being like a really horrible, hideous person. So basically be the same. Alexa's always listening to me, says that darn kitty. Well, often I think about all these devices around us, and we joke about how Apple and Google and the rest of them kind of know what's going on because they're always listening. And that's how you end up being served ads for things that you talk about. Siri is always listening, says Arbot. Alexa, Siri, all of these things. So if you have a device anywhere near you, chances are that it's spying on you. Someone somewhere is listening. No point in... And think about the fact that we just discussed in the first hour of the show how the phone is with you all the time. So if it's with you all the time and it's listening all the time, then somewhere there's all this information being stored up. It's no wonder that people are able to find out things that you probably guess that they wouldn't know, and then you discover too late that they know everything.
Oh gosh, XR says those toys in the back or background of Leanne's are actually spies. Those eyes are cameras.
Yeah, that Charizard or whatever it is from Pokemon. That thing's probably listening to you as you speak. If it starts moving or it replies, then you know you're a
problem. Oh, no, don't freak me out. No, I'm still alone here.
All right. That's plenty of beating up on Gen Z and phone tips for us for this morning. I think it's time for us to talk to somebody who really does know a lot about the state of mental health in South Africa, because there's been a lot of news coverage recently about Life Estimeni and the fact that, they've found the former MEC caused indirectly the deaths of mental health patients by moving them into these smaller institutions and out of life estimeni. And that was, of course, Qedani Mahlangu, who's probably going to go to jail, I would imagine, when all of this is said and done. We've had inquests with Dikgang Moseneke and so many other people. And the judge last week made some very damning remarks about the responsibility the MEC has for causing the death of these mental health patients in life estimeni. It was a horrible story when it came out. It just seems to get more horrible over time. And I feel so sorry for the families of these people. And you know, it's hard enough to get care and consideration if you are a mental health patient, but then to be treated like this, and for the Gauteng Health Department to have thought they could get away with it, is just absolutely disgusting. It's devastating. So I thought we would talk this morning to Professor Christopher Paul Szabo. He's, of course, the former professor and academic head of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Witwatersrand, head of the clinical department at the Department of Psychiatry at Charlotte Mangkhaeke Johannesburg Academic Hospital. And he's also the host of our podcast series that we've been doing for a couple of years now called Beyond Madness. It's always good to talk to you, Prof. How are you?
Where am I? Can you hear me and can you see me?
Loud and clear. And you look crazy, which is always a good look for a professor of psychiatry.
You're catching me first thing in the morning. I haven't had my six beers yet to go lie in the sun.
Don't worry.
Yeah, you can see I'm doing this with my hands. It's pretty frosty in Johannesburg.
It's nice to see you. I haven't seen you in ages. It feels like much too long.
Yes.
There's so many things in the news that I want to talk to you about, but been happening with you? How have you been? I mean, let's spend a couple of minutes catching up. What's news?
Well, a couple of months ago, I took a decision to step back from my clinical practice, because after I left the Department of Psychiatry at WITS and Gauteng Health, which was about April 2019, I then focused just on doing clinical work in the private sector, which I did for the last couple of years. And I got to a point where I decided I needed to step back, take a break from everything, and just to see where I might want to go with my life. So you could say that I'm probably on sabbatical, not that I'm doing nothing, and not that I have any specific goals in mind, but I'm just learning how to be. I think
you know what, Prof? Change is as good as a holiday, and I'm sure for anybody who feels like they need a change, the best thing you can do is just take a little break from the usual, the humdrum rat race stuff, and kind of reevaluate. It's something that everybody should be doing every couple of years, no matter what they do, right?
Well, I think you talk about mental health, and I think there does come a time where you start to, for example, in your daily routine, start to feel that it's just not working for you anymore. And it's not about the people or the routine. It's just not working. And you have to get to that point where you say, okay, when am I going to take that decision to step back, reflect, review, and maybe reorientate myself in terms of what I want to do? And it's not easy. And maybe you could say that I'm doing it from a more privileged position. I've been working for 30, 40 years. So that's the point that I get to. But even at my age, which I'm not going to reveal, but even at my age, you can decide for yourself. You get to a point where you say, okay, when am I going to live my best life? And I would hope that we are all living our best lives every single day. But there comes a point sometimes where you're just not feeling it. And then you need to think very seriously about what you want to do with your life, and whether you're just going to wait for things to get better or whether you're going to try and make things better. And I think that's the issue.
So, I mean, it must be a massive change for you, and there must be quite a lot of trepidation around giving up your clinical practice, because for a few decades now, you've been helping people and sitting with these nutcases, you know, I know you won't call them that, I will, and trying to help them. I mean, someone in the comments section says here, Prof, you would have your hands full with us in the chat, says Percy.
And I think that's what I'm here. Right.
Yeah, do you think that you're going to miss it, or is it too soon to make that kind of a call?
You know, I can honestly say I've had a fantastic career and I've enjoyed every minute. And I think that's the point, is that you need to be enjoying it as you started out? You know, there was a time when I started out specializing in psychiatry where I used to wake up in the morning and think, geez, am I getting paid to do this? I better keep quiet because I'm just enjoying it that much. And at the end of the day, if that starts to turn and that starts to change, then you need to reflect. And at the end of the day, there was some trepidation. I remember a friend said to me when I was contemplating this, and this was when I was going to leave the state sector academia, and he said in his position, he can't afford to leave. And I said, yes, I can't afford to stay. And I think the issue there is that you need to be looking at the extent to what you're doing, firstly, in terms of how it defines you, but more specifically, how does it feed you? And I don't just speak here about the financial. I speak about the spiritual. Is it feeding your soul? You have to feel it. And I think that maybe I'm speaking more esoterically, but truly, that's what it came down to. This is not feeding me in that sense. And I don't want to prejudice those I'm there to serve by being less than in a particular situation. And so then you have to step back, reflect, and maybe you'll go back into it. And maybe it's just that you need time out. Maybe you're a little bit burnt out, whatever. Yeah. Or there's a whole new direction waiting for you. And you'll only uncover that when you step back and you allow it to reveal itself. And I think that's what's important. And I think what's difficult is not knowing, because everybody's question is, so what are you going to do now? And my response is, I'm going to do nothing. I'm just going to be. And I'm just going to pursue the things that interest me. And I think that's often very difficult for people. What do you mean? It's like you haven't got that next thing. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes nothing is the next thing in that moment.
So, you're not going to become some yogi or swami and like go to India and, you know, run a clinic.
No, listen.
Meditate for 24 hours a day.
I've been to India twice. And I think that that's not my intention at all. I don't know, you know, because then if you're going to get into that, then you're talking about what? Developing another following, because eventually when you develop a following, what do you have to do? You have to serve. And so sometimes it's the service that becomes difficult. Sometimes you just want to be free of that and give yourself a chance to recharge. You don't necessarily want to recreate it, but I might, you never know.
So before we leave like the mental health world that you've been such an important part of in South Africa behind, and before we kind of move on to new discussions and new things and new stimulating ideas, what do you think the state of mental health care in South Africa is? You know, this Life Estimeni story, which I opened up with, is just such a disturbing and horrible indictment of the quality of mental health care in South Africa. I don't think we've ever taken it seriously enough. I know you have some very strong feelings about this too, and you've experienced it from the inside and out.
Yeah.
But what do you think South African mental health care is really like? And how many people in this country are getting what they really need?
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking to myself, I don't know that I want to see this as an indictment of mental health care. I want to see this as an indictment of the system of mental health care. Because remember, who were the protagonists in this tragedy, this disaster? Not the carers, it was the administrators.
Yeah.
That's where your problem was. And I think that as a good friend of mine, Leonard Erickson, he's a psychiatrist down in Pennington, and he was actually part of Life Estimeni before this all unfolded. He doesn't really want to look at it as the Life Estimeni tragedy. He's more inclined to look at it as the Gauteng Department of Health tragedy. And I think that one has to be very careful in not seeing this as an indictment on mental health care. I think it's the administration. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think one of the things that one learns when you work in institutions are generally only as good as their administrators. You need good administration, but the administration has to be actively engaged with one of its key stakeholders, the clinicians, never mind the patients and the patients' families and all the other stakeholders who are part of the equation. And I think one of the big failings in terms of the Life Estimeni tragedy was the extent to which clinicians were ignored. So when you speak about, you know, whether it's an indictment on mental health care, I would prefer not to see it that way. And in fact, not prefer, I do not see it that way, because I know the people as clinicians who are all committed. And when I speak about clinicians, obviously they're psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, nurses, occupational therapists. There's a whole team. And that's the one thing that really defines psychiatry and sets it aside from other medical specialties is the multidisciplinary team. We work as a team. Every patient is viewed by a team, certainly in the state sector.
So then let's leave that to one side and not talk about the system so much and the administrators, but let's talk about the quality of mental health care in this country. You and I have had many discussions about how there aren't enough social workers, there aren't enough psychologists, there aren't enough psychiatrists for the population numbers and for the difficulties that people are having. And you know, life in South Africa is tough for so many people, let alone those who have very serious mental health conditions. We know that there isn't the support that people might need, in particularly in rural areas. But what do you what do you make of that, especially with the benefit of the lens of the years of experience that you've got in this sector?
Well, you see, the question really becomes how many psychiatrists is enough? And of course, how many of each will be enough? And I mean, there are obviously norms and standards in terms of what is ideal in terms of numbers per 100,000 population. If you just take psychiatrists, because obviously that's where I'm coming from. Mm. I mean, the last data we have, which goes back to 2019, is that we have 1.52 psychiatrists per 100,000 population in South Africa. So that's a specific number. In other African countries, it goes down to 0.01. In European countries, it can go as high as 30. So, you know, okay, so how do you make sense of that? And for me, ultimately, maybe it's not so much a number, it's are the people who have a need having that need serviced. So one has to be careful when you're looking at numbers, as if you reach a certain number, you're done. Of course, when you look at that number, you have to further divide it down into private sector versus state sector, and very specifically, because you've alluded to that, urban versus rural. And I think that if you look at the rural population in this country, we're talking about 0.03 psychiatrists per 100,000. So there is a definite underservicing of the rural setting relative to the urban setting. And then in South Africa, it gets even more specific in terms of province. So certainly Gauteng and the Western Cape are probably the best in the urban areas, are the best serviced. I think Gauteng has something like 2.6 per 100,000 and the Western Cape 5.2 per 100,000. So you're seeing this variation within the country. You're seeing it by comparison to other countries within continent and beyond. So what does that all mean at the end of the day? And again, I come back to, is the patient getting what they need? And again, just to go back to the multidisciplinary element of what we're talking about in terms of psychiatry, there are many players who are forming part of the team. So it's not that every single person who has a psychiatric condition necessarily has to always be seeing a psychiatrist. And I think that also has to be clearly understood. And not every difficulty that a person experiences in their life necessarily qualifies as psychiatric. You know, we can all have emotional difficulties or struggles at any particular point in time. We don't need to see a psychiatrist.
Prof, do we have any idea of the number of undiagnosed mental health conditions in the country? I mean, there are probably people in rural South Africa, some of whom must be going through some very serious stuff. You know, we have issues with malnutrition. We have issues with abuse. We have all kinds of very fertile ground for people to develop very, very serious conditions. We're not talking about, like, you know, some Gen Z teenager who's got like anxiety. We're talking about serious, serious problems. I wonder how much of that we even have a grip on, we even have a hold on, we even have some idea of in terms of the scale of it. Because we are a country that we have serious issues. Like, people, there's a lot of trauma in this country. There's a lot of real lack of resources, lack of basic healthcare, let alone mental healthcare, and violence and all kinds of really shitty things that make it difficult for people to develop while their brains are still soft as kids or as young adults, the right mental health environment, the right kind of container for all of that stuff?
Well, I mean, it's always difficult to know what you don't know, because you don't know what you don't know. So one can only assume. So, I mean, there is data. And once again, you know, we get into numbers where there was the South African Stress and Health Study, which goes back to 2009. So it's old data, which was kind of an epidemiological survey using standardized questionnaires going into populations and looking to see what is the prevalence of diagnosable mental illness. They did interviews, etc. So if you look at a 12-month prevalence, and the most common psychiatric conditions in that sense would be anxiety disorders, substance abuse, and mood disorders. Those are your big three. And we're looking over a 12-month period of anything between 5 to 8% of the population. That's a lot. That's a lot of people who are potentially, and these are not patients that they were talking about. This was going into the community and looking at a stratified sample, etc. So to answer your question, there may be a lot of undiagnosed mental illness out there. But I think what's important is really not necessarily to categorize it as mental illness, but there is certainly emotional distress and there is struggle. So then you ask the question, okay, so what do you do about that? Where does that go in terms of care? And then we start getting into issues of self-awareness, how one is aware of oneself in terms of what one is experiencing, in terms of mood or behavior, and how you're impacting on your immediate environment. And I think using the word immediate environment, I'm talking family, friends, peers, workers, schoolmates, depending on your age and where you are. And I think good mental health probably starts with sound communities. Because at the end of the day, what is the foundation of our being? And one would like idealistically to assume it comes from the home, our parents, our grandparents, family, grandparents. You know, one of the biggest, there was a very good article that was published a little while back, and the terminology within the title was Deaths of Despair. And they were looking at suicide, substance abuse, and poor physical health within the context of United States of America versus 16 European countries, and seeing how the deaths of despair have increased in the American setting, and looking at what is going on in their society, and the issue of breakdown of family, the loss of three generation families, grandparents, parents, children, being reduced to the nuclear family, mom, dad, children, being reduced to the single parent. Yeah. And so what we're seeing is this change in societal structure, and then the link with your neighbors, your community, and the breakdown there, where we've become increasingly isolated, and loneliness is a big issue. So when you
I feel like I've been asking all my questions, but Leanne, who's got serious mental health problems of her own,
she's
oh my God. Are you joking? she's got lots of questions.
Yeah, there's no problem with being undiagnosed in this head. It's all been diagnosed. It's all been medicated, and it's all under control. No, just picking up.
We'll take your word. We'll take your word for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just picking up off of what I've seen in the comments is that it's still such a misunderstood phenomenon, mental health. And because I've, you know, learned things myself, firstly through studying a little bit at Varsity when it came to psychology, secondly, just having an interest in it, having family members who have required either, you know, psychological or psychiatric treatment. And just, you know, with being a journalist and an inquisitive mind and wanting to know all these things, I'm still so shocked how some people don't understand psychology, don't understand psychiatry. Some people still think it's not necessary. And that must be a massive thing in rural areas particularly, where you're set aside as somebody who's crazy or the spirits are taking over their bodies and they never get treated, never get diagnosed. I mean, that must still be the biggest thing, one of the biggest issues here.
Well, I think that in the rural setting, and not just the rural setting, but in the urban setting as well, you cannot ignore traditional healers. And I think that we have a very specific understanding of what mental illness is from a Western perspective. And there are different interpretations. And I think there are different pathways to care. I think increasingly there is an awareness of what constitutes something that a traditional healer could realistically deal with. And those would generally be issues within a person's life that don't necessarily represent something, for example, like schizophrenia with frank delusions and psychotic phenomena. So I think that in certain settings, there are different modalities of care that exist, which don't necessarily conform to how we in a Western setting and a Western biomedical setting would look at things. And so I think in South Africa, the role of the traditional healer, I think, is being increasingly explored and I think understood. And I think there's more collaboration between medical professionals and traditional healers. And certainly psychiatry has been very sensitive to that for the very reasons that you've kind of alluded to, where, for example, it might be seen that what we would necessarily regard as constituting a psychiatric disorder may be viewed very differently in that setting. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there may be an inclination to move the person away from the biomedical situation into the more traditional, which may not always be in the best interest of the patient, obviously, or the individual with the problem. And that's where the liaison comes in. And I think one has to respect the fact that there are alternative pathways and that there are alternative systems of care. And I think as a psychiatrist, one needs to be very cognizant of that, very mindful of that, very respectful of that. And you've got to work with that within your patients. Yes.
I'm fairly fascinated by the, and it's come up quite a lot in conversations I've had with people, this idea of generational trauma and you know, the epigenetic kind of stuff that, and I know you and I are both interested in this stuff. Have we seen any real and meaningful developments in respect of kind of the research around this stuff? Have we got any better a handle on what that might be? Because we know in so many parts of the world, not just South Africa, there are deep scars that do go across generations. And, you know, we like that term, the phrase, the sins of the father shouldn't be visited upon the son or the daughter. But I think, you know, the genes carry so much information that we don't completely understand. And I'm pretty sure that there's a nature and a nurture element to this stuff. Have we made any real progress lately on discovering what that might be?
I'm not sure that we have, to be honest with you. Maybe artificial intelligence will do it for us. There's another threat, but to the environment. But I think that the idea of genetics and destiny, I think, also has to be looked at, because you mentioned the term epigenetics. And there we're looking at the fact that you and I may have, let's say, the same genetic vulnerability, but the environment that we grow up in, the experiences that we have, kind of also shape how those genes are expressed. So I think that the sort of interaction between gene and environment is something which we understand as exists. And so the question is, if I have a certain genetic vulnerability, am I destined to manifest it in a pathological way? And the answer is not necessarily, because I do think the environment plays a role. So now we get back to things I was talking about earlier, the foundational aspects of our being in terms of family, society, values, etc., etc. How do those impact and how do those affect gene expression ultimately? And I think when you talk about epigenetics, that's to some extent what one is looking at. I can remember doing a BBC program once because they thought they had discovered a gene for anorexia nervosa. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, yeah, that's interesting. I said, I don't believe that's possible. You know, because in psychiatry, this understanding that you have one gene for a disorder and that there's a straight line, that's pie in the sky, as far as I'm concerned. Psychiatric conditions are multifactorial, they're complex. There are so many interacting factors, which then speak to the fact that there must be multiple genes, and how they interact to produce what you ultimately see is very complex. But coming back to the issue of genetics, and so, okay, we think we've got a gene for anorexia nervosa. And I said, okay, so now what? You're going to screen the population and you're going to say, well, you've got a gene for anorexia, but I'm not anorexic. So now what? And so one has to be careful that this idea of genetics as the answer to everything leads or doesn't lead to, well, now we need to screen, because if we screen and we identify, then we can prevent. How about we screen, we identify, and we label? And I think you've got to be very, very careful, because, you know, psychiatry as a discipline understands all about stigma. So with the intention of potentially doing something good, you actually end up doing something bad, the law of unintended consequences. So I can remember also writing an article exactly about that, where one has to be cautious in terms of what you do with information and also why you're gathering information. So I'm not saying that, you know, this should stop and we shouldn't be looking into these things. But the point is, you have to understand consequences. And so my concern in that instance, and they didn't disagree with me, where I said, well, okay, what are you going to do with this information? Fine. So you've got a gene. And now what? So, you know, I think there's a lot of expectation, and there's a lot of hype and excitement, and it's genes and genetics. And
yeah,
I think one just has to be a little bit cautious and a little bit wary and think downstream and say, okay, if I do this, what then? And you have to look at the consequences very broadly. And I think, you know, unintended consequences. I can come back to life esse demeni, unintended consequences.
Yeah.
You know?
And I suppose also a lot of this stuff creates an external locus of responsibility, which is not the best idea for people who have to take ownership of their own problems. And more we are seeing people presented with the option of blaming something other than themselves, or not just blaming, but taking responsibility.
Yes.
So, you know, it's my genes. It's the fact that my parents didn't buy me enough toys or hug me enough when I was a kid. It's the government's fault. It's the economy. It's the leaky roof in my house. It's anything except me taking charge of what I want to do about something. Sure, we all, you know, have problems, and some people have more than others. And even the least sympathetic of us can understand that that's a good starting point. But where do you go from there? You can't just sit and wallow and blame everybody else. That's possibly the worst route for anyone to take if they're dealing with serious or not so serious mental health conditions.
Well, I think you're talking there about locus of control. Where's the locus of control? And this word agency. We all have agency at the end of the day. Yes, you've had a difficult childhood. And I mean, the whole issue of adverse childhood experiences impacting on subsequent emergence of psychopathology. I think that there's no two ways about it, that certainly, and I think this is one of the issues in psychiatry, actually, you know, child and adolescent psychiatry. And remember, I come from an adolescent psychiatry background. I ran the adolescent unit at Tara for just on a decade. So I've really worked with some of the most severely disturbed and ill adolescents. But I'll tell you one thing with adolescent psychiatry. As soon as you put that adolescent, as disturbed as they were, and I would say this in virtually every single case, into a structured, nurturing, predictable environment, a lot settled. And a lot of what we saw emerging as psychopathology, I always used to say to my staff, what is the context? The context is critical. Where does this child come from? What were they missing? What do they need? Now, at the end of the day, I think that, again, we're coming back to the foundations of good mental health. And the environment was so powerful in terms of how it mediated the emotions and the behaviors. And so this whole issue of locus of control, that we all have agency, that we've all had difficult experiences, the question is, how do we deal with them? And does every bad experience then justify bad behavior or ways of being that are just destructive. People are different. Everybody has a different way of experiencing, and then they have different experiences towards dealing with what they've experienced. Mm-hmm. Now, does that mean that everybody who's had a difficult experience needs to end up in a caregiving environment? Well, you know, if that was the case, never mind the resources that we have now, we would just never have enough. So ultimately, it comes back to the individual. How do you manage yourself? How do you understand yourself? And who do you turn to yeah. actually deal with? So,
one last thing. I mean, this is really so apt for today's discussion, because we started the show talking about this Donald Trump assassination attempt. And the fact right. that the guy who did this, we don't know a lot about him yet. People are starting to scour the internet to try and find information about this. Crooks is his surname.
Yes, 20 years old.
Yeah, he's 20 years old. You know, a lot of people are making snap judgments about this, which is dangerous. And I want us to be responsible about how we figure out the way to make sense of this, because obviously, yes. there are lots and lots of people who have serious problems in their life, and they don't end up trying to kill a presidential candidate. But it does seem like
there's a certain
kind of person, and I mean, a lot of people saying just losers. You know, like there's this loser thing. These people who are disconnected from society, they spend most of their time online gaming. And I'm not saying all gamers are crazy, because I know lots of gamers who are perfectly sane, sensible, rational people who are connected to the real world. But people are starting to make snap judgments, and without like us taking the same tack and trying yeah. to come up with the simplest explanation for something which is probably very complex. What makes a person decide to do something so stupid, to essentially figure out that the best thing they can do is to make their impact on history, probably get taken out at the same time? I don't think anyone decides to do this without knowing that there's a hugely likely possibility they'll be taken out themselves. Where do we go with this?
Well, I think you have to look at each individual. And so my standard answer to always, you know, in those situations, well, I haven't spoken to the person. So it's very difficult for me to understand what exactly motivates him. But I mean, let's bring it back to the South African situation and Hendrik Verwoerd and the Verwoerd assassination. Correct. And Tsafendas was ultimately mentally ill, and he had believed he had a worm inside him. And, you know, so I could say to you, well, psychosis could be one driving factor based on my understanding of a specific case. And I suppose that each individual has their own motivation, Gareth. It's hard to say and to be very specific and say, well, if you're this kind of person, this is what you're going to do. Because again, what is the predictive value in any given situation? Because I may, for example, share similar personality traits to an assassin. Now, what does that mean? That I am somebody who is now potentially at risk for becoming an assassin? I don't know. It's complex. There are a lot of variables that interact that bring you to that point of committing an act like we've seen. So we don't know. I mean, I don't know anything about this 20-year-old who's he's dead now. So at the end of the day, we're supposed never going to find out exactly what was going through his head and what was going through his mind. But, you know, there are so many situations where one has to just be very, very cautious, very careful, and I think it's appropriate. And I would say, I can't comment. I never spoke to him. So,
and what about the role of the media in kind of pushing people who are on the edge, people who may be extremely sensitive to doing irrational and crazy things? What about the media's responsibility in not pushing those people to the point where they'll take very bad decisions and possibly create chaos in the world? It doesn't take a lot to persuade someone who's in that state of mind, does it?
No, but I would be very cautious in terms of how I implicate the media. I mean, I can look at the media and say that's inflammatory, that is disinformation, that is incorrect. But ultimately, it comes back to me as an individual in terms of how I interpret the media. So this whole issue, I can remember when I was working in the eating disorders unit, I used to go to the schools and talk about eating disorders. And eventually I stopped talking about eating disorders and I started talking about media literacy and in terms of how you interpret media, because of course this whole issue around fashion, models, diet, etc. And so the issue there was, is the media implicated in eating disorders? And my response was always, well, the media does what the media does. And to what extent does the media reflect society versus influence society? And I think that there is a bi-directional relationship there. So I think one has to be careful in saying, they said this, therefore that happened. But why did they say that? Well, because maybe other certain things were happening. So the issue is the media and society. I think one has to look carefully at what the relationship is. Certainly in terms of suicide and the media, we did a podcast on that with the Beyond Madness series. And certainly, you know, how the media reports on suicide, that has been looked at in terms of not wanting to promote copycat suicides. So I suppose in that sense, one can potentially soften the impact through responsible reporting. But the truth of the matter is, here we're talking about an American situation which is politically very charged. It's very partisan and it's very divided. And I mean, so is this the media? What is it? What is driving this climate? And to what extent does that then influence actions by specific individuals who are vulnerable? But how do you account for that vulnerability, Gareth? I mean, at the end of the day, how do you know what your words are going to do? I can be sitting here today talking to you and I say something which I think is just kind of run of the mill. But yet there'll be somebody listening who'll say, wow, that is such a powerful sentence. And it has a really profound impact. And it wasn't my intention to impact that individual in that way, but I've got no clue. I mean, people will often come up to me and say, you know, ex-patients. And they will say, you know, you said whatever. And I'm thinking, geez, did I say that? And they said, yes. And that had such a profound impact on me, that sentence. So now you're coming down to a sentence at a particular moment in a person's life, in a particular interaction, and how powerful that is. How am I going to predict what that sentence is, what that word is? And so I think that one has to just be very careful in terms of how one looks at the media. I'm not saying that the media should not be responsible. Of course they should, and they have to think carefully about their words. But I think to draw a straight line between that and the actions of an individual who we don't know who they are really and what they were experiencing, I think one just has to be a little bit cautious, as much as one needs to also be mindful. So it's that balancing act. Oh, we come back to a word that I like to use, balance. It's all about balance.
Yeah, you know what? Basically, let's just be clear on this show. We don't like people who assassinate, and we're not in favor of that. So, just in case anybody's wondering, like, this show does not promote assassinations.
No, it's an assassination-free show.
Yeah, there we go. All right, listen, Prof, we're running out of time.
All right,
it's been so good to reconnect with you.
Likewise,
love talking to you. Always, likewise, plenty of insights. And Leanne, thank you for getting to the office extra early so you could do the show with us this morning. All right, very good. And that is it from us, everybody. We will see you on Wednesday morning, bright and early, 6 a.m. Don't miss it. We will be back in studio with all the stuff that you want and all the stuff that you need, and hopefully plenty more than that. So thank you very much. Cheers, everyone. Bye.
Cheerio. Ciao.